an Osho talk. Walk without feet, fly without wings, and think without mind. Number 2.
The first question. Do you believe in you? Do you believe in God? Who is God? No, I don't believe in me. I cannot, because I am not. There is nobody to be believed in, and nobody to believe in it either. If you believe in yourself, you believe in an illusion. The very belief will prevent you from knowing the reality. Once you start believing in an illusion, you start losing contact with the real. To know the real, all illusions have to be dropped, and the greatest illusion of all is the ego, the I. You ask me, do you believe in you? No, not at all. That's why I am able to know. You ask, do you believe in God? No, again. Because to believe in God is not to know Him. Belief is always out of ignorance. Those who don't know, they believe. If you know, what is the point of believing in? When you know, you know. You don't believe in the morning sun. You don't believe in the trees and in the mountains. You need not. You know the sun is there. You know the people are there. You know the trees are there. There is no question of belief. Why do you believe in God? Because you don't know. You substitute your knowledge by belief. You hide your ignorance behind the belief. The belief gives you a pretension of knowing. All beliefs are pretentious. All beliefs are deceptions. Whom you are deceiving? You yourself are deceived. When a man says, I believe in God, he is saying he has not been able to know God. That's all he is saying. He is not strong enough to say that way. He is not strong enough to see his own ignorance and accept it. Hence he says, I believe in God. What is the need of believing in God if you know? Knowledge never becomes belief. Knowledge remains knowledge. Ignorance tries to become belief. Remember always, whenever you believe, it is just to hide your ignorance. It is a cheap knowledge that belief gives. I don't believe in God. Because any relationship of belief is a wrong relationship. I know God. But to know God, the only requirement is that I should not be. The moment you disappear, God appears. Only when you are spacious enough to contain Him. When you are no more there, occupying inner space, in fact, absence of yourself is the presence of God. Remember, you will never meet God. You cannot. Because the meeting will mean you are also real and God is also real. Then there will be two realities, not one. And reality is one. If you are, God cannot be. If God is, you cannot be. And the third thing you ask, who is God? God is not a who. He is not a person. God is the totality, the sum total of the whole existence. God is not somebody. God is allness. I am God. You are God. Everybody is God. All is God. In fact, to use the word God is not right. There is godliness and no God at all. To be really true to reality, godliness is the right word to use, not God. The moment you say God, many things arise out of that word. First, God becomes a person. And God is not a person. God is impersonal existence. God is impersonal beingness. Once you say God, God becomes a He. That is male chauvinistic. That is ugly. God is neither a he nor a she. And if you decide to use he or she, then she is far better. Because she includes he. But the he does not include she. She is far more bigger. Naturally so. Man is born out of the woman. The woman can contain the man. The man cannot contain the woman. The man has no womb to contain. But both are wrong. God is neither man nor woman. Because he is not a person at all. Then, what God is? Don't ask who is God. Ask what is God. Life is God. Love is God. Light is God. It is an existential experience. You never come across God like an object. You come across godliness like an inner upsurge. Something blooms in you. And you cannot find even the flower. Just a fragrance. God is not a flower, but a fragrance. I cannot indicate where God is, who God is. I can simply relate to you my experience of fragrance. The existence is full of godliness. Everything is divine. The flowers, the birds, the rocks, the rivers. Not that you have to create a temple for God and a church for God. That is stupid. Because God is everywhere. For whom you are creating the temple and the church and the mosque? If you want to pray, you can pray anywhere. Wherever you bow down to God. because none else exists. You will have to understand my language. Belief is a dirty word here. And by belief, you are prevented from knowing. You are not helped. And it is because of belief man is divided. It has not helped man's spiritual growth. It has been one of the greatest barriers. It is belief that divides you as a Christian, a Hindu, a Mohammedan. It is belief that divides the earth. It is belief that creates wars. The moment you believe, you are no more one with humanity. You are a Christian or a Hindu or a Mohammedan. You have gone ugly. You are poisoned. And now you will be continuously fighting for your belief. And all these people fighting for their belief are blind people fighting for their belief in light. And nobody knows what light is. I have heard the policeman was walking his beat when he saw two men fighting and a little boy standing alongside them crying, "Daddy, Daddy." The officer pulled the two men apart and turning to the boy asked, "Which one is your father led?" "I don't know," the boy said, rubbing the tears from his eyes. "That's what they are fighting about." Do you really know who is God? You don't know even who you are. How can you know who God is? You have not even become acquainted with the closest reality that is beating in your heart, that is breathing in you, that is alive in you. And you are thinking to become acquainted with the totality of existence, the infinite, the vast, the eternal. And you have not been able even to have a taste of your own being. You have not tasted even a single drop of the sea, and you want to taste the whole sea. And you never go to the sea. You go to the scriptures. You never go to the sea. You go to the priests. And then you create belief. And the belief comes out of your fear, not out of your love, not out of your knowing, not out of your experience. It comes simply out of your fear. You believe because alone you feel afraid. Because you are childish. You want somebody to hang to cling to. You need a father figure so that you can always look up to, so that you can always throw the responsibility, so that you can always cry and weep and remain helpless. It is out of your fears you have created gods. And a God created out of fear is ill. It is pathological. It will not bring you well-being. It will make you more and more pathological. The so-called religious man is almost pathological. He is neurotic. You go to the monasteries. You look around with open eyes and you will be simply surprised that in the name of religion, 1001 kinds of pathologies are practiced. People don't become healthy and whole. They become more and more helpless, more and more frightened, more and more eccentric. Of course, their neurosis is such that it is respected. Freud is right when he says that religion is a collective neurosis. I agree with him. The so-called religions are neurotic. If a single person behaves in that way, you will think he is mad. But if a big crowd behaves in that same way, you think it is religious. Just the other night I was talking about a follower of Mahatma Gandhi. His name was Professor Bhansali. He took a vow of silence. Now, the real silence never arises out of vows. The very phenomenon of the vow indicates that the silence is imposed, false, pseudo, violent. Otherwise, there is no need to take a vow. If you have understood the beauty of silence, you will be simply silent. Why take a vow? Why decide for tomorrow? Why say that from now onwards I will remain silent and I will not speak a single word? Against whom you are taking the vow? If you have known the beauty of silence, if you have experienced the joy of it, if you have melted in it, if you have flown into it, what is the point? You never take a vow that I will love my whole life, I take the vow. You don't take the vow that I will eat my whole life. You don't take the vow that I will go on breathing till I die. This will look foolish. You enjoy love, there is no need to take the vow. People take vows for celibacy, not for love. Why? Because celibacy is unnatural, imposed. When celibacy is also natural, spontaneous, no vow is taken. Now this man, Professor Bhansali, I knew the man, took a vow of silence, went to the Himalayas. For 2 years, 3 years, he remained in silence. It was hard struggle. It was continuous fight with oneself. It was repression. Great repression. He must have become split. The one who is trying to impose the vow and the one, the natural one, who wants to have a little chit-chat with people, or to talk, or to relate, communicate. One night he was sleeping, and somebody in the darkness walked over him. He was fast asleep. In his sleep you cannot remember your woe. He shouted, "Who are you? Are you blind or something? Can't you see I am sleeping here?" Then he remembers that he has broken his vow. Naturally, he felt very guilty. Great guilt arose in him. He had taken the vow and he has broken it. And he was really a masochist. Otherwise, why one should take the vow of being silent? Talking, communicating to people is such a joy. Why one should become enclosed into one's own being? This is morbid. But now he was guilty. To punish himself, he started eating cow dung. But that was not enough. To punish himself, he sewed his lips with a copper wire. Even that was not enough. Insanity notes no limitations. He jumped into a cactus bush and rolled naked thousands of thorns in his body. And he will not allow the thorns to be removed by anybody. There were wounds and wounds all over the body. But he became very famous. He became a Mahatma. People started coming towards him, worshipping him. Now, what you will call this man? Will you call him a Mahatma? If you have any senses left in you, you will call him that he is pathological. He needs psychiatric treatment, maybe electric shocks. He needs psychoanalysis. But he was a famous disciple of Mahatma Gandhi. Just next to Mahatma Gandhi. This has been happening down through the ages. There have been Christian saints who have been beating themselves every morning, wounding their bodies. And people will come to worship them and to see who is wounding him more. And the person who was wounding him more than others, of course, was a greater saint. Now, these people who were wounding themselves, killing themselves slowly, they were pathological, and the people who used to come to see them, they were also pathological. The saints were masochists, and the onlookers and the worshippers were sadists. They both were in a subtle, ill state of affairs. There have been saints who have cut their genital organs. There have been women saints who have cut their breasts. What you will call these people? But they live according to the belief. They are believers. Man has to get rid of all this kind of stupid religiousness. Man has to get rid of all this nonsense that has persisted down the ages. It is because of this nonsense that religion has not become part of everybody's life. No, religion need not be based on belief. Religion has to be based on experience, not on fear, but on love. Not on negation of life, but on affirmation of life. Religion has not to be a belief, it has to be a knowing, an experiencing. That's why I say belief is a dirty word here. Knowing, loving, being, these are real words. And belief hinders them. You cannot know if you believe. You cannot love if you believe. You cannot see if you believe. And remember, I am not saying that you have to disbelieve. Because disbelief is again a belief. The atheist and the theist are not different. They are in the same boat. They are fellow travelers. The theist believes God is, the atheist believes God is not, but both believe. Their beliefs are antagonistic. But as far as belief is concerned, both are believers. There is not much difference. What I am saying is, neither belief is needed, because you don't know how can you believe. And you don't know how you can disbelieve. When belief and disbelief both are dropped, there is silence. When belief and disbelief both have disappeared, you are open to truth. Then you don't have any prejudice. Then your mind is no more projecting. Then you become receptive. Neither believe nor disbelieve. Just be watchful, receptive, open. And you will know. And what you call that knowing does not matter whether you call it God, or you call it enlightenment, or you call it nirvana, does not matter. These words are just words. Any word will do. X, Y, Z will do. But first you have to get rid of belief and disbelief. Getting rid of belief and disbelief, you get rid of the mind. And only a state of no mind comes to know. The state of no mind is blissful. The second question, is not Shankaracharya enlightened? Then why did you drop the proposed series of talks on him? He is enlightened. Perfectly enlightened. My dropping of the proposed series of talks does not mean that I am saying that he is not enlightened. But his expression is run of the mill. Very ordinary, mundane. Traditional, conventional. His expression of his experience is ordinary. Buddha's expression is extraordinary. Buddha's expression is special. That does not mean that their experiences are lower or higher, no. Enlightenment is enlightenment. There is no higher, no lower. What Buddha knows, Shankaracharya knows. It is like this. You go to the Himalayas. You see the beauty of the Himalayas. And the virgin silence. And those peaks covered for millions of years by pure snow. You feel it into every pore of your being. Your every fiber vibrates with that benediction that Himalayas is. You come back and somebody asks that, would you please paint a little picture so I can see something of your experience? I have not been fortunate to go to the Himalayas, but can't you paint a little picture? Now there will be differences. If a Wangag had gone to the Himalayas, he will paint a totally different kind of picture. If you paint, it will not be a Van Gogh. You don't know how to paint. Still, you have been to the Himalayas as much as Van Gogh. Or somebody says to you, can't you sing a song about your experience? No, songs will be different. They are bound to be different. A poet will be able to sing beautifully, will be able to compose poetry. Your poetry will not be much of a poetry. at the most a limerick. It cannot be great art. It will depend on your skill. Buddha is a vanguard of that world. So is Tilopa. So is Sarha. So is Hakun. These are aristocrats of that world. Shankara is ordinary. Even when I had chosen it very reluctantly. I was thinking to drop many sutras. There are few diamonds, but 99% is rubbish. If you search deep enough, you will find few diamonds. But 99% is valueless. Buddha's sayings are all diamonds. You will not find rubbish at all. In Shankara, you may be able to miss the diamonds. But in Buddha, it is impossible to miss. It is almost impossible to miss. You can miss one, you can miss two, you can miss three. How can you miss so many diamonds? A row of diamonds. Shankara is enlightened as much as Buddha is. But his expression is mediocre. That's why he has impressed the Indians very much. Buddha has not impressed. Buddha remained so high that he passed over the heads. Shankara has impressed very much. Shankara is one of the most important names in Hinduism. Buddha has no place. What happened? The mediocre mind found Shankara very appealing, close. There was some affinity between Shankara and the mediocre mind. And the crowd is mediocre. To understand Buddha, you will have to become an individual. To understand Shankara, if you are an individual, it will be difficult. You will have to be crowd. Shankara's statement is for the crowd. He went deep into Indian mind. He impressed the Indian mind very much. Buddha disappears. Indian mind lost track of Buddha. There was great distance. But if you want to go to the Himalayas, why not go to the Everest? That's why I dropped that series. The third question, why are parents so cruel to their children? Is there any sense in making them responsible? And how can one avoid making the same mistake? Parents are cruel to their children because parents have some investment in them. Parents have some ambitions they would like to fulfill through their children. That's why they are cruel. They want to use the children. The moment you want to use somebody, you are bound to be cruel. In the very idea of using somebody as a means, Cruelty has entered. Violence has come in. Never treat another person as a means, because each person is an end unto himself. Parents are cruel because they have ideas. They want their children to be this and that. They would like their children to be rich, famous, respected. They would like their children to fulfill their unfulfilled egos. Their children are going to be their journeys. The father wanted to be rich, but could not succeed. And now death is approaching. Sooner or later he will be cut off from life. He feels frustrated. He has not yet arrived. He was still searching and seeking. And now comes death. This looks so unjust. He would like his son to carry on the work. Because his son represents him, himself. He is his blood. He is his projection. His part. He is his immortality. Who knows about the soul? Nobody is definite about it. People believe, but belief is out of fear. And deep down the doubt remains. Each belief carries the doubt in itself. Without the doubt, there cannot be any belief. To repress the doubt, we create the belief. But the doubt remains, gnawing in the heart, like a worm in the apple. It goes on eating inside you. It goes on rotting you from the inside. Who knows about God and who knows about soul? They may not be. The only immortality known to man is through children. That is actual. The father knows, I will be living in my son. I will be dead. Soon I will be under the earth. But my son will be here. And my desires have remained unfulfilled. He imposes those desires, implants those desires in the consciousness of his son, that you have to fulfill them. If you fulfill them, I will be happy. If you fulfill them, you have paid your debts to your father. If you don't fulfill them, you have betrayed me. This is from where cruelty comes in. Now, the father starts molding the child according to his desire. He forgets that the child has his own soul, that the child has his own individuality. That the child has his own inner growth to unfold. The father imposes his ideas. He starts destroying the child. And he thinks he loves. He loves only his ambition. He loves the son also because he is going to become instrumental. He will be a means. This is what cruelty is. You ask me, why are parents so cruel to their children? They cannot help. Because they have ideas, ambitions, desires, unfulfilled. They want to fulfill them. They want to go on living through their children. Naturally, they prune, they cut. They mold, they give a pattern to the children, and the children are destroyed. That destruction is bound to happen unless a new human being arises on the earth who loves for love's sake. Unless a new parenthood is conceived, you love the child. just for the sheer joy of it. You love the child as a God's gift. You love the child because God has been such a blessing to you. You love the child because the child is life, a guest from the unknown, who has nestled into your house, into your being, who has chosen you as the nest. You are grateful and you love the child. If you really love the child, you will not give your ideas to the child. Love gives never any ideas, never any ideology. Love gives freedom. You will not mold. If your child wants to become a musician, you will not try to distract him. And you know perfectly well that a musician is not the right kind of job to be in. That he will be poor. That he will never become very rich. That he will never become a Henry Ford. Or the child wants to be a poet. And you know, he will remain a beggar. You know it. But you accept it because you respect the child. Love is always respectful. Love is reverence. You respect because if this is God's desire to be fulfilled through the child, then let it be so. You don't interfere. You don't come in the way. You don't say this is not right. I know life more. I have lived life. You are just ignorant of life and its experiences. I know what money means. Poetry is not going to give you money. Become a politician rather. Or at least become an engineer or a doctor. And the child wants to become a woodcutter. And the child wants to become a cobbler. Or the child simply wants to become a vagabond. And he wants to enjoy life. Rest under trees and on the sea beaches and roam around the world. You don't interfere if you love. You say, okay. With my blessings you go. You seek and search your truth. You be whatsoever you want to be. I will not stand in your way. And I will not disturb you by my experiences. Because my experiences are my experiences. You are not me. You may have come through me, but you are not me. You are not my copy. You are not to be my copy. You are not to imitate me. I have lived my life, you live your life. I will not burden you with my unlived experiences. I will not burden you with my unfulfilled desires. I will keep you light and I will help you. Whatsoever you want to be, with all my blessings and with all my help. The children come through you, but they belong to God, they belong to totality. You don't possess them. You don't start thinking as if they belong to you. How they can belong to you? Once this vision arises in you, then there will be no cruelty. You ask, why are parents so cruel to their children? Is there any sense in making them responsible? No, I am not saying that there is any sense in making parents responsible. Because they have suffered, because of their parents, and so on and so forth. Understanding is needed. Finding scapegoats is of no help. You cannot simply say, I am destroyed because my parents have destroyed me. What can I do? I know parents are destructive. But if you become alert and aware, you can get out of that pattern that they have created and woven around you. You always remain capable of getting out of any trap that has been put around you. Your freedom may have been encaged, but the freedom is such, is so intrinsic, that it cannot be utterly destroyed. It always remains, and you can find it again. Maybe it is difficult, arduous, hard, uphill task, but it is not impossible. There is no point in just throwing the responsibility, because that makes you irresponsible. That's what Freudian psychoanalysis has been doing to people. That is its harm. You go to the psychoanalyst, and he makes you feel perfectly good, and he says, what can you do? Your parents were such. Your mother was such. Your father was such. Your upbringing was wrong. That's why you are suffering all these problems. You feel good. Now you are no more responsible. Christianity has made you feel responsible for 2,000 years. Has made you feel guilty that you are the sinner. Now, psychoanalysis goes to the other extreme. It simply says you are not the sinner. You are not to feel guilty. You are perfectly okay. You forget about all guilt. And you forget all about sin. Others are responsible. Christianity has done much harm by creating the idea of guilt. Now, psychoanalysis is doing the harm from the other extreme by creating the idea of irresponsibility. You have to remember, the parents were doing something because they were taught to do those things. Their parents had been teaching them. They were brought up by parents also. They had not come from heaven directly. So what is the point of throwing the responsibility backwards? It doesn't help. It will not help to solve any problem. It will help only to unburden you from guilt. That is good. Good part. The beneficial part of psychoanalysis is that it unburdens you from guilt. And the harmful part is that it leaves you there. It does not make you feel responsible. To feel guilty is one thing. To feel responsible is another thing. I teach you responsibility. What do I mean by responsibility? You are not responsible to your parents. And you are not responsible to any god, and you are not responsible to any priest. You are responsible to your inner being. Responsibility is freedom. Responsibility is the idea that I have to take reins of my life in my own hands. Enough is enough. My parents have been doing harm. Whatsoever they could do, they have done. Good and bad, both they have done. Now, I have become a mature person. I should take everything in my own hands and start living the way it arises in me. I should devote all my energies to my life now. And immediately you will feel a great strength coming to you. Guilt makes you feel weak. Responsibility makes you feel strong. Responsibility gives you again heart, confidence, trust. That is the meaning of sannyas. Sannyas wants you to be free from Christianity, Hinduism, Jainism, Mohammedanism. And sannyas wants you to be free from Freudian psychoanalysis and things like that too. Sannyas wants you to live your life authentically, according to your innermost voice, not according to any other voice from anywhere, not according to the Bible or according to the Quran. If God has spoken in a certain way in Quran, it was specifically meant for Muhammad, not for you. It was God's dialogue with Muhammad, not with you. You will have to find your own dialogue with God. You will have to find your own Quran. If Jesus has spoken those beautiful words, they are out of the dialogue that happened between him and the totality. Now don't go on repeating them. They are meaningless for you. They are not born in you. They are not part of you. They are like a plastic flower. You can bring a plastic rose and hang it on the rose bush. Yes, they are like that. It is not the same when a rose flower comes out of the rose bush itself. You can deceive people. Those who don't know may be deceived. They may see so many beautiful flowers are blooming on the rose bush, and they are all plastic. But you cannot deceive the rose bush. You cannot deceive yourself. You can go on repeating Jesus, but those words have not been uttered in your ears by God. They are not addressed to you. You are reading a letter addressed to somebody else. It is illegal. You should not open that envelope. You should search and find your own relationship with the totality. That relationship I call responsibility. Response means a spontaneous capacity to relate. Response means capacity to respond to life situations according to your heart, not according to anybody else. When you start feeling that, you become an individual. Then you stand on your own feet. And remember, if you stand on your own feet, then only one day you will be able to walk without feet and fly without wings. Otherwise not. And you ask, and how one can avoid making the same mistakes? Just try to understand those mistakes. If you see the point why they are committed, you will not commit them. Seeing a truth is transforming. Truth liberates. Just see the point why your parents have destroyed you. Their wishes were good, but their awareness was not good. They were not aware people. They wanted you to be happy. Certainly, they wished you all happiness. That's why they wanted you to become a rich man, respected man. That's why they curved your desires, cut your desires, molded you, patterned you, structured you, gave you a character, repressed many things, enforced many things. They did whatever they could. Their wish was right. They wanted you to be happy, although they were not aware what they are doing. Although they had themselves never known what happiness is. They were unhappy people and unaware. Their wish was good. Don't feel angry about them. they did whatsoever they could. Feel sorry for them, but never angry for them. Don't feel any rage. They were helpless. They were caught in a certain trap. They had not known what happiness is. But they had some ideas that a happy person is one who has much money. They worked for it their whole life. They wasted their whole life in earning money. But they remained with that stupid idea that money brings happiness. And they tried to poison your being too. They were not thinking to poison you. They were thinking they are pouring elixir in you. Their dreams were good. Their wishes were good. But they were unhappy people and unaware people. That's why they have done harm to you. Now be aware. Search happiness. Find out how to be happy. Meditate, pray, love. Live passionately and intensely. If you have known happiness, you will not be cruel to anybody. You cannot be. If you have tasted anything of life, you will never be destructive to anybody. How can you be destructive to your own children? You cannot be destructive to anybody at all. If you have known awareness, then that's enough. You need not ask and how one can avoid making the same mistakes. If you are not happy and aware, you cannot avoid making the same mistakes. You will do the same mistakes. You are bound to do. You are doomed to do the same mistakes. So I cannot give you a clue how to avoid. I can only give you an insight. The insight is, your parents were unhappy. Please, you be happy. Your parents were unaware, you be aware. And that two things, awareness and happiness, are not really two things, but two aspects of the same coin. You start by being aware, and you will be happy. And a happy person is a non-violent person. And always remember, children are not adults. You should not expect adult things from children. They are children. They have a totally different vision, a different perspective. You should not start forcing your adultish attitudes upon them. Allow them to remain children, because it will never be again. And once lost, everybody feels nostalgia for the childhood. Everybody feels those days were days of paradise. Don't disturb them. Sometimes it is difficult for you to accept children's vision, because you have lost it yourself. A child is trying to climb the tree. What you will do? You become immediately afraid. He may fall. He may break his leg. Or something may go wrong. And you rush out of your fear. And you stop the child. If you have known what joy it is to climb a tree, you would have helped so that the child learns how to climb the tree. You would have taken him to a school where it is taught how to climb the tree. You would not have stopped. Your fear is good. It shows love that the child may fall. But to stop the child from climbing the tree is to stop the child from growing. There is something essential about climbing the trees. If a child has never been doing it, he will remain something poor. He will miss some richness. For his whole life, you have deprived him of something beautiful. And there is no other way to know about it. Later on, it will become more difficult for him to climb on the tree. It will look stupid, or foolish, or ridiculous. Let him climb the tree. And if you are afraid, help him. Go and teach him. You also climb with him. Help him learn so he doesn't fall. And once in a while, falling from the tree is not so bad either. Rather than being deprived forever, the child wants to go in the rains and wants to run around the streets in the rain. And you are afraid he may get cold or pneumonia or something. And your fear is right. So do something that he is more resistant to cold. Take him to the doctor. Ask the doctor what vitamins should be given to him so that he can run in the rains and enjoy and dance and does not. And there is no fear that he will catch cold or will get pneumonia. But don't stop him to dance in the streets when it is raining. It's such a joy. To miss it is to miss something very valuable. If you know happiness and if you are aware, you will be able to feel for the child how he feels. A child is jumping and dancing and shouting and shrieking, and you are reading your newspaper, your stupid newspaper. And you know what is there. It is always the same. But you feel disturbed. There is nothing in your newspaper. But you feel disturbed. You stop the child. Don't shout. Don't disturb daddy. Daddy is doing something great, reading the newspapers. And you stop that running energy, that flow. You stop that glow. You stop life. You are being violent. And I am not saying that the child has always to be allowed to disturb you. But out of 100 times, 90 times, you are unnecessarily disturbing. And if you don't disturb those 90 times, the child will understand. When you understand the child understands you. The children are very, very responsive. When the child sees that he is never prevented, then once you say that, I am doing something, please, the child will know that it is not from a parent who is constantly looking to shout at him. It is from a parent who allows everything. Children has a different vision. Now I want it quiet, said the teacher. So quiet, you can hear a pin drop. A deep silence descended on the classroom. After about 2 minutes, an anguished voice from the back shouted, "For Pete's sake, let it drop." It was the little boy's first day at his school. And as soon as his mother had left him, he burst into tears. Despite all efforts on the part of his teacher and the headmistress, he went on crying and crying until finally, just before lunch, the teacher said in exasperation, "For heaven's sake, shut up, child. It is lunchtime now, And then in a couple more hours, you will be going home and you will see your mummy again. At once the little boy stopped crying. Will I? He said, I thought I had to stay here until I was 16. They have their vision, their understanding, their ways. Try to understand them. A understanding mind will always find a deep harmony arising between him and the child. It is the stupid, the unconscious, the non-understanding people who go on remaining closed in their ideas and never look at the other's vision. Children bring freshness into the world. Children are new additions of consciousness. Children are fresh entries of divinity into life. Be respectful, be understanding. And if you are happy and alert, there is no need to be worried how to avoid not to commit the same mistakes you will not commit. But then you have to be totally different from your parents. Consciousness will bring that difference. The fifth question, I came to Pune because you are a master and I have been seeking for one for a long time. How can I find out whether you are my master? Will I only have to believe what you say about that, or will I be able to recognize you? Somehow I am waiting for something to happen which will make my inner voice say yes and surrender. My relationship with you just seems to be in my head, but I don't feel that I can do anything to change it. Can you? First, you say I came to Pune because you are a master. Don't believe rumors. And you say I have been seeking for one for a long time. Why you are so against a master? Why you are seeking for so long a time? Why you should be interested so much in a master? For what? You should seek yourself. If you seek yourself, you will find the master. The ancient saying is, when the disciple is ready, the master appears. How can you seek a master? You will not be able even to recognize. You may come across. You may not be able to see. Seek your own being. Go deeper into your own being. Go deeper into your own silence. And then suddenly when you need a master, he will appear. He always appears. Now you are on a wrong track. And if you are looking too much for the master, you will go on missing. At least here for a few days you are. Drop that search. Just be here and you may find. Meditate, dance, sing and be here. Forget that search. Don't go on looking by the corner of the eye for the master. Your very look, your very effort, your seeking will prevent you. The very desire comes in between. The relationship with a master is possible only when there is no desire. In a non-desiring mind, it happens. And you ask, will I only have to believe? No, not at all. I am the last person to say you to believe in me. Just be here with me. That's enough. If you are here with me, I am going to happen to you. It is a promise. But don't seek and search. Enough for today.